Welcome to the Science Podcast for October 19th, 2012. I'm Edward Hermy.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, revisiting the formation of the moon, why male birth control hasn't taken off, and a new twist on optical data transmission.
If we're talking about one unit of information these days in optical transmission being, say, 100 gigabits per second, and then we want to be able to multiply that.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Imagine transferring hundreds, thousands, even more times the amount of information than current fiber optic cables allow. Theoretically, researchers can imbue light beams with an endless amount of information by changing the shape of the path of light or its orbital angular momentum. The orbital angular momentum, or OAM, of a beam of light in this case can be envisioned as a helix, the path twisting around a central axis. By generating light with a specific orbital pattern, detectors can now collect more information from each beam of light. Soyeon Yu and colleagues have improved upon the design of these emitters by reducing their size from millimeters down to micrometers. I spoke with Yu from his office in Bristol.
So we wanted to use the light with orbital angular momentum for our photonic information systems, including optical communications and for quantum photonic information systems. But we don't want to use lenses and other bulk materials. Instead, we want to use integrated chips because they are always more convenient and robust for applications. So we came up with this idea of angular grating and implemented this in the silicon chip and then successfully emitted many light beams with the required orbital angular momentum.
So you're describing integrating light with angular momentum.
Mm-hmm.
What does this actually mean?
Yes, so in optics, we used to think that the light rays travels in straight lines, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the light rays actually are indications of how the energy of the light travels. The straight line picture is true in free space in most of the cases. But there are other modes of light propagating. OAM light beams, they have light rays that travels in a twisted manner when they propagate forwards. So this is in contrast to any other light beams. The orbital angular momentum is a quantum mechanical concept. One can imagine that the photons in the light, when they propagate forward, they orbit around the axis of the beam. We know that anything that rotates has angular momentum. So the angular momentum is just the tendency to keep rotating. So, for example, the Earth in its orbit around the Sun has a lot of orbital angular momentum. So one mm-hmm. could imagine the photons doing similar things.
So the photon itself is just spinning?
It's not spinning. Spin is another concept. Spin is rotation around its own axis, while orbiting is it's rotating around another object or around another center of axis, shall we say.
Okay, so it has a curved trajectory? Okay.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So does light naturally have any curve to it?
Actually, although we all say that light travels straight, it is only true for plane waves. In fact, most of the waves that we see are not plane waves. For example, we are maybe familiar with Gaussian beams from lasers,
mm-hmm.
and these actually have light rays that bend as well because of diffraction. So the light rays would diverge or converge depending on the wavefront of the beam, whether the wavefront being concave or convex. But in all those beams, the light rays, they don't twist. So that's the difference between those beams and the orbital angular momentum beams.
So getting into your methodology, how exactly did you give light angular momentum?
Basically, what you do is you try to create a phase shift around the axis of the beam. So if you, say, cut the light across its axis, normally you would see the light in that plane to be all of the same phase. That's true for other types of beams. But for orbital angular momentum beam, what you need to do is you try to create a phase shift as you go around the center of the beam. And so the wavefront now is no longer plane. Instead, the wavefront looks a bit like a helix.
So I guess the main point of your article was that you were not giving light angular momentum for the first time, but you were able to reduce the size of this technique compared to previous attempts, right?
Exactly, because the orbital angular momentum itself was discovered 20 years ago. And so people have been creating these beams using wave plates, cylindrical lenses, you know, all those sort of like optical elements that we are familiar with. But of course, for our application, those are not very convenient. So we want to come up with a small size, compact and robust chip.
And how much smaller were you able to get?
You know, ours is not the first attempt to make a chip that emits OAM beams. A previous chip, which was made by Bell Labs, they used many waveguides and arranged ends of those waveguides in a circular fashion. And so they tried to make the phase shift between those waveguides fairly precise. And then each waveguide would emit part of this angular momentum beam. But the problem with that is fairly complicated, and the device tends to be quite large. We are talking about more than a millimeter in size. What we managed to do is use only one waveguide, and we make this into a ring, and then we make this grating in the ring. So the light in the grating is scattered out by each tooth of this grating. So each grating tooth emits part of the beam, because the phase shift between those two teeth of the grating is fixed, because it's fixed in the shape. And then we got a very simple and very robust device, because the phase between them cannot go wrong, because it's all fixed.
So why did you actually want to create this kind of device? What are the applications?
We have been working in photonic information systems, which include both classical optical communication systems and also quantum information systems. And so that's the applications we had in mind when we started doing this research. And it also turned out that people working in lab-on-chip systems and the optical sensing systems, they may find the OAM beams to be quite useful. So there are many applications in those areas as well. But for us, the primary applications we are interested in are for the information.
Focusing on information, what would encoding this new level of angular momentum into light actually mean?
Okay, so if you think these days that we carry one unit of information, say, using one frequency of light, that's mm-hmm. what we usually do. So if you think that as a dot, then you add OAM onto it, you can expand this dot into an array of dots. Each dot in that array then corresponds to a different OAM value. And then all of these are still the same optical wave at the same optical frequency. So we can now use each one of those dots to represent a different unit of information. We can also further use the many more different combinations of those dots to represent even more units of information. So now we have multiplied the amount of information that can be carried by a single optical frequency. So in that way, we can increase the capacity very, very significantly, because in theory, there is no limit to how many OAM values one can create for each optical frequency. So the theoretical potential is quite enormous. It is basically how many bits per second that you can transmit, right? And so if we're talking about one unit of information these days in optical transmission being, say, 100 gigabits per second, and then we want to be able to multiply that.
So going from kilobytes to megabytes to gigabytes to...
Yeah, we go from, say, 100 gigabytes, maybe up to terabytes per second and beyond. And in fact, combining many different kinds of multiplexing technologies, for example, we already have WDM, which is wavelength division multiplexing, that already can transmit, say, 100 channels in the fiber using 100 different frequencies. Mm-hmm. If we then multiply those 100 frequencies each with, say, 10 or 50 OAM values, then we got another enormous increase.
Wow. So for the practicality of this, could we use the same optic cables that are already in use today?
I think it is unlikely that current optical fibers can support this kind of transmission. We are likely to have to use some new optical fibers. But I've been aware of some interesting new fibers now being developed by several vendors. And in fact, they appear to be deployed fairly soon. That might actually be suitable for transmission of OAM light. there will be a lot of technical difficulties to overcome, but in principle, it sounds as if those fibers might actually be okay. In that case, then it would be to replace the transmitters and the receivers in order to implement the system using those fibers. Because by the time these technologies are mature, those fibers would be in ground already. What we are doing is that, you know, we hope that our devices will be a suitable technology for the transmitters and the receiver chips for the future OAM-based optical communications and the quantum information systems.
Well, Su-Yun Yu, thanks for talking with me.
Right, thank you very much.
Su-Yun Yu and colleagues describe a new emitter for light encoded with information through orbital angular momentum in this week's Science.
We know that more than 4 billion years ago, a massive planet-sized rock smashed into the young Earth, flinging into orbit the debris that would eventually coalesce to form the Moon. But a few key aspects of our current model of the Moon's formation just don't add up. This week, Mattia Chuk and his co-author offer a new interpretation of that ancient impact.
Recent research has shown that the Moon appears to be made from Earth's mantle. And the current giant impact model of lunar formation cannot explain that because it predicts that the moons have been made from parts of other planets that collided with Earth. We propose a version of the giant impact hypothesis, which has the moon derived from Earth, and propose that early Earth was spinning very fast, which enabled material to fly into orbit. Then we propose that the Earth has been spun down through an orbital resonance, that is a complex gravitational interaction between the Moon and the Sun.
Okay, so you're essentially revisiting the model for how the Moon formed through an impact with Earth billions of years ago. So what's wrong with the current model? Why does it need updating?
Well, it explains the physics very well, but the chemistry does not seem to be right.
Mm.
And we've only realized that in the last 10 years as the lab techniques have improved. And people analyzing moon rocks realize that it looks exactly like the mantle of the Earth.
Hmm.
And the point of comparison would be meteorites from Mars or meteorites from other bodies like giant asteroid Vesta. Those are more or less planetary bodies that also have mantles and cores, and their mantles are very different from what the Moon is made of. So if the Moon was made from parts of a planet that collided with Earth, we would expect the so-called isotopic signature of the Moon to be as different from Earth as meteorites from Mars or Vesta are, but actually the Moon looks, as far as we can tell, exactly like Earth.
So you're not actually abandoning the current model of the Moon's formation, you're just sort of revising it to account for these geochemical inconsistencies.
Exactly.
So what does your new model entail?
So it's two steps. The two steps are connected by the idea that early Earth could have spun faster. So one step is to show that that would actually solve the problem, that in a collision, which includes other planets, Mars-sized or maybe smaller, and fast-spinning Earth, you can get the disk around Earth, which would eventually form the Moon, to be made primarily from Earth's mantle. The other step is to show that this fast-spinning Earth, which has more angular momentum than Earth and the Moon have now, could have lost angular momentum later on.
Mm.
So my collaborator, Sarah Stewart, has worked on the first part, and I have been working mostly on the second part, involving the orbital interaction between the Moon and the Sun, which drained the angular momentum from Earth and the Moon and transferred it to the orbits of Earth around the Sun.
Well, let's focus on the first part for now. So how do you think the impact that formed the Moon would differ from what's in the current model?
We got best results with a body that's about a half the size of Mars. But unlike in the past giant impact simulations, we have this body coming in at 20 kilometers a second, which is typical of asteroids striking Earth, but it's much faster than had been proposed before. And what it does is basically break up Earth and twist it in violent ways. And Earth material flies. Some of it flies out all the way to orbit around the Sun, and some of it flies into orbit around Earth, and the remainder settles back, and soon Earth goes back into a more or less round shape.
Hmm.
But the impact itself is much more violent than has been envisioned before.
And as you said, your model also incorporates a faster spinning Earth. So why would the Earth have been spinning so quickly in the first place?
That is not so unexpected. People have been making computer simulations of planets forming, and the way the planets form, planets like Earth, is they are formed in mergers of smaller protoplanets, which are then formed in merger of smaller things. And they collide at rather large speed. So you end up with rather fast-spinning bodies that are formed from mergers of these very fast-moving protoplanets. And the only thing that really puts a cap on how fast they can spin is gravity still has to hold them together.
Hmm.
And a planet spinning faster than about 2 hours would fly apart.
And so how did the Earth and the Moon then slow down to the spins and the orbits that we observe today?
So as the Moon was moving away from Earth due to tides, it reached a point at which its whole orbit was rotating around Earth once per year. So this slow rotation of the whole orbit is usually called precession, and it's different from the motion of Earth or Moon around the Earth, which happened in less than a day in those days. So this yearly motion of the orbit around Earth was matching the yearly motion of Earth around the Sun, which made the Sun and the Moon interact very strongly by the gravity and effectively made the orbit of the Moon get stuck at this distance and could not move any further, because if the orbit would get bigger, it would break the special relationship between the Sun and the Moon. But tides kept acting and giving angular momentum from Earth to the Moon. So angular momentum had to go somewhere, and the lunar orbit was stuck. So it was transferred over to the Sun. Actually, the other way to think about it was transferred into the orbit of Earth around the Sun. So Earth's distance to the Sun increased ever so slightly, much less than 1%. But that's where the angular momentum went. Eventually, as Earth was spinning down, this relationship could not hold for Earth that was not spinning very fast, and it broke apart. And after that, the Moon continued moving out, just like we always thought, and it reached the present state.
Very interesting. So we have interactions not just between the Earth and the Moon, but also with the Sun.
Yeah.
So does this mean that the spins in the orbits of the Earth and the Moon are still in flux today? Are they still changing, or have we reached essentially an equilibrium?
The interactions through tides depend very strongly on the distance. So when Earth and the Moon were close by, this interaction was fast, like in this episode we are describing in the paper. Right now, since the Moon is pretty far away, the interaction is slow. So the Moon is still moving away, but only by a little bit more than an inch a year. So it hasn't reached the equilibrium, but it's not changing very fast at this point.
So how does this influence our interpretations of early Earth? You know, how the planet differentiated, things like mantle convection and cooling. Could this actually have an impact in any of those areas?
Well, most of this interaction is orbital and is between the Moon and the Sun. However, it does depend on how the tides operate. Both tides raised by the Moon and Earth, and by Earth and the Moon. And these tides, when you're talking about Earth, were not in the ocean. Probably Earth was completely molten and had a lava ocean. And there is a particular prediction in the model about how much tidal dissipation you need within Earth and the Moon at a time. So that's a prediction in the model that Earth might have been more dissipative, that the tides on Earth might have been stronger than tides raised on the Moon early on. So since we make a definite prediction about the strength of tides within early Earth versus tides within early Moon, people who model the interior of Earth early on will have to see if our predictions are consistent with what we know about early Earth, or if interior models need to be changed, or maybe if our orbital model needs to be modified.
So how do you think your new model for the Moon's formation will be received within the Earth science and planetary science community?
So our paper is coming out together with another paper on the same topic by Robin Canup from Southwest Research Institute, which has a similar approach of having fast-spinning early Earth, but uses a giant impact between two large bodies colliding slowly, while our approach is having a small impactor, smaller than Mars, impacting really fast.
Mm.
But basically, it's the same solution to the problem, that early Earth was fast-spinning, and both rely on the orbital resonance to lose angular momentum. And otherwise, the reaction in the community so far has been rather positive. I think that people have been uncomfortable with the giant impact with us. And while it explains physics very well, it has been uncomfortable how the results about the geochemistry have contradicted giant impact. And I think people will be happy to have a new research. This is certainly not the last word on the subject, but I hope this sticks and the field moves in the direction of a paper.
Great. Well, Mattia Chuk, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mattia Chuk and Sarah Stewart discussed the formation of the moon in a paper published online this week. You can read the article at www.scienceexpress.org.
The science behind the birth control pill has been around for years, but why is it the birth control pill when it only works when women take it? Sam Keen looked into the lack of male-specific oral contraceptives and found out that science is not the only hurdle to blocking pregnancy from the male side of the equation. Sarah Crespi spoke with Keen about new approaches to a male pill.
Well, I saw a study about a year and a half ago now, that mentioned that they were ending this big trial of male contraceptives early because there were too many side effects. And I just got curious about why there was no complement for males of the female pill, since that's been around for so long and it's been such an important medicine. And I remembered sort of in the back of my brain that there had been other attempts to make male contraceptives, but they had always failed too. And so I was just curious about whether there might be someone out there doing work on a different approach to male contraceptives, or if maybe there was one in the works that could be coming to the drug company soon.
So, as you say, we've had the female pill for a really long time, over 50 years. Why has it been so difficult to make a similar type of pill that works for men?
Well, it's a bit of a tricky question. I asked one of the researchers that, and she sort of scolded me a little and said, we do have drugs that will effectively and very reliably stop the production of sperm in men. It's not that hard to do. The problem is there are often side effects. And when you're talking about women being pregnant, you know, it causes a lot of different effects, things like high blood pressure, you know, there's a not insignificant chance of dying, things like that. So you can kind of take that into account, kind of weigh that when you're talking about using and developing a female pill. With males, there's no kind of counterbalancing risk of pregnancy. So you basically can't tolerate any side effects, especially because you're giving this to men who are usually pretty healthy anyway. So you can't have problems just crop up. It will not work as a drug for that reason. So that's the basic problem, is that the calculus for men and women when it comes to side effects is very different, and there's basically zero tolerance for side effects in men.
So you talk about several different approaches that people are actually taking to try to make a pill for men that maybe meets some of these criteria. Even one that was first tested in the 50s and researchers are now looking to again. Can you tell us about that drug?
That pill was interesting. It was a compound called WIN-18446, I think was the name of it. And they did actually a study in prisoners. And they found out that it worked really well. It stopped sperm production. It was completely reversible. The men were otherwise healthy. When they moved it to the general population, though, they found out men were getting very sick. And they finally traced it back to drinking alcohol. The problem was the prisoners can't drink, obviously. Men who were drinking would have this very strong reaction to it. They would kind of get poisoned almost because the alcohol wasn't getting cleared out of their system. It's a good example of a side effect that was intolerable in the general population. And there are scientists today who are working with variants of this drug to hopefully try to tweak it to make it more specific for the enzymes that are involved just in sperm production. And so it won't have that general effect in the entire body. But there's a lot of tweaking going on, because the processes that sperm need to develop are processes that go on in the rest of the body. They're just a little bit different inside the sperm. And so they're hoping that by tweaking these drugs, they can be very targeted and very specific.
Right. You talk about how it doesn't make sense to take a similar tack, like the pill for women, and just attack testosterone, for example. That has a bunch of side effects that are undesirable. Well, what are some of the processes that are being tackled by researchers?
Yeah, when you mentioned the female pill basically manipulates hormones.
Mm-hmm.
And they've tried that in men, especially with testosterone, to manipulate the hormones. But as you said, testosterone works in a lot of different tissues. You can just turn it way up or turn it down or whatever, because it's going to affect a lot more than just sperm production. So what they've really been focusing on lately is going after certain types of cells and certain genes that are only involved in sperm production,
mm-hmm.
and trying to shut those down. One promising approach mm-hmm. involves retinoic acid, basically vitamin A. And we use vitamin A all throughout our bodies, but sperm really depend heavily on vitamin A. And again, there are certain enzymes that are very specific to sperm that use vitamin A in a very specific way. So they're hoping that by interrupting that process, vitamin A inside the testes, that they can basically halt sperm production without affecting other cells in the body.
Well, let's talk a little bit about who's doing this research. Are drug companies taking the active dominant role in developing and funding this?
No, not at all. And that was actually a frustration for some of the scientists. Was drug companies, they said, have been interested. They've been talking to them and saying, hey, you know, let us know if you have any leads.
Right.
But they're really not putting money toward it. So they're having to rely on government grants for this. And there have been a couple companies that have shut down programs within the past decade. Some scientists did speculate a little bit about why, but the drug companies seemed a little reluctant to talk about their reasons for shutting this program down. And, you know, they might have some good reasons for doing it. Maybe the best reason is it is, again, very hard to make these pills without side effects.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some other reasons they might, too. It might not be worth the financial reward, considering how hard it is to bring a drug to market, or there
right.
could be other reasons as well.
And what is the FDA's role in at least regulating this kind of drug in the U.S.?
That was a little tricky, too. The FDA obviously is, you know, involved in setting the guidelines for what level of safety and efficacy a male pill would need. But the FDA right now really doesn't have any guidelines, and they didn't even really want to talk about the possibility of developing guidelines. So that's another thing that makes it kind of hard for a drug company to develop a male pill, is they don't even really know what to shoot for.
Right,
if you're going for other drugs, you can be very clear and say, we need to do this and this and this, but it's sort of up in the air with a male pill right now.
So they're just assuming that no side effects is probably the best thing to aim for, but they haven't really gotten that guidance from the FDA.
Yeah, exactly.
Huh. So if the drug companies aren't that interested, or at least aren't expressing any financial interest in forwarding these kinds of drugs, what about the researchers who are involved? Do they expect the market to be really good for a male contraceptive like this?
Yeah, they are optimistic about it. One of the people I talked to said that, you know, when people come up to him at cocktail parties, whatever, and he tells them what he does, they say, oh, men aren't interested in contraception. But people involved in this field really don't think that that's the case. Before the female pill was developed, males actually were responsible for most contraception. And they said that males are responsible, even today, for around 30% of contraception. So there are definitely men interested in this, they said. And they think that actually a lot of couples will sort of double up. They use the mm-hmm. male and the female pill just to really make sure that there's no chance of a pregnancy. Another complication is that some women can't take the pill. You know, there are either side effects for them, or they just don't feel right on it, or whatever the reason. Again, they are optimistic that there will be a demand for this pill once they can get at least one out there and show that it works.
All right. Well, Sam Keen, thanks for talking with me.
No, thanks for having me.
Sam Keen is a contributing correspondent for Science. He writes about male contraceptives in this week's issue.
Finally today, I'm here with online news editor David Grimm, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. So Dave, let's start with the bad news. In our first story, we're talking about dangerous complications to a clinical drug.
Well, right, Carrie, this has to do with what's called an anti-shock drug known as hydroxyethyl starch, or HES. And HES is a synthetic derivative of regular starch. It's a large molecule that binds liquid. It's commonly given to patients who have lost a lot of blood. It's not really a blood substitute, but it keeps up the blood volume. The idea was that it would prevent the circulatory system from collapsing because you would have enough volume in, you know, your veins and arteries to keep circulation going.
And this is not the first time that we've heard about this drug. There have been other clinical trials and other studies going back to the early 2000s. So tell me a little bit about the history of clinical trials of this drug.
Well, ever since 2001, there's been some concern that HES might be doing actually more harm than good. There was a 2001 study in The Lancet that suggested could potentially be harmful to patients. And in June of this year, there was a clinical trial conducted in Denmark that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which actually found that septic patients, these are patients with really severe infections, when they were treated with HES, they were significantly more likely to die within 90 days of getting the treatment. And also, a lot of them needed kidney replacement therapy than those that were treated with an alternative, which is called Ringer's acetate.
Wow, these are some serious complications, and this can't be good news. How has the medical community responded to this series of studies?
Well, what happened was after this study was published in June, a company that makes one of the HES compounds that's called Voluvin complained that the study that came out in June didn't include its HES compound, and therefore its HES compound was unfairly lumped in with all these other HES compounds that were thought to do harm. So actually this new study, which was just published this week, also in the New England Journal of Medicine, involved data from more than 6,000 patients. And this time they did use Voluvin. And what they found was that of the patients treated with HES, 18% died versus 17% of those treated with the saline solution. So there was really no difference between the drug and the control. And what's more, kidney replacement therapy was more often needed, and there were higher rates of bleeding and itching in the HES group than in the control group. So this trial really kind of puts the nail in the coffin that it seems like most, if not all, of these HES compounds are really problematic and really sort of suggest that doctors might want to think twice before they use this, or at least realize that these compounds have a lot more dangers than were previously thought.
And onto a more positive study, we've got more on the possible advantages of reading.
Right. And this is specifically reading that's done with children early in life. And not just reading, but any sort of educational stimulation. You know, it makes intuitive sense that the more we try to teach our children when they're young, and the more time we spend with them, and the more time we spend reading with them or sort of engaging them in, you know, intellectual activities, the hope is that they're going to be smarter growing up. And there's a lot of evidence for this. What this new study really adds is that these activities can actually change the very structure of the brain.
Right. So as you said, Dave, there have already been a lot of studies relating reading and education to, you know, the development of our early brain. What did they do in this study to show something new here?
Well, what they did was they looked at 64 children from a low-income background, and the researchers visited the children a couple times at home when they were both 4 and 8 years of age, and they were looking for things like, you know, the number of books the kids were reading, the number of educational toys in their houses, even how much warmth and support they were getting from their parents. And then 10 years after the visit at 8 years old, the researchers used an MRI machine to really look at detailed images of the children's brains. Well, they weren't so much children anymore. They're sort of young adults at this point. And what they found was that the level of mental stimulation that children received had a strong correlation with the thickness of two regions of the cortex. And this is sort of the main region of the brain. Actually, what was interesting, they found that more stimulation was associated with a thinner cortex.
And we want a thinner cortex?
Surprisingly, we actually do. It turns out that when the brain develops, it produces more synapses, or these are the neural connections between cells, than are needed. And typically what happens is these underused connections are later eliminated. This elimination process, which is actually called synaptic pruning, is actually really important. It actually makes our brain more efficient. You can sort of think of it as a highway. And maybe if you only got one straight shot to where you need to go, you're going to get there a lot faster, versus if the highway gives you 5 different ways to get to the same place, it can get confusing. Things can sort of slow down. And sort of the same thing happens in our brain. So we actually really do want a thinner cortex. And actually what we really want is a more efficient cortex. And what the study is really showing is that these early educational experiences really do help make the brain a lot more efficient.
Well, it sounds like when the researchers were observing these kids when they were very young, that there were a lot of variables, not just books, but also toys and their home environment. I mean, is this a fail-safe link between cortex development and books specifically?
Well, that's a good question. The researchers actually looked at other factors like the intelligence of the mother and the degree and the quality of her care, and they found that these things didn't have an effect on the thickness of the cortex. It was really this educational stimulation, these books and the educational toys, that really seemed to have the most impact.
Very exciting. All right, and from early infancy to early humans, this last story is one that we can really sink our teeth into.
That's right. Carrie, this story concerns some fossilized ribs that were found in a very ancient site known as the BK site in Tanzania's Olduvai Gorge, which is a very famous fossil bed. And a lot of the fossils here are more than a million years old, and a lot of them belong to our human ancestors. So this is a really sort of important place in the world to sort of figure out what our ancient ancestors, how they were living, and what they look like. And researchers sort of scouring the site, they found these ribs from prehistoric antelopes. And what was really interesting about the ribs is they bore marks from stone tools. And this suggests that early humans had dined on them. Now, that's not really that surprising. I mean, obviously we had to eat back then and we were developing tools. So we would have been using our tools to get meat off bones. What was interesting about this particular find is that the researchers found that some of the fossil ribs, they had been peeled back.
Peeled back. So what's the significance of that?
Well, if you can sort of think of yourself eating ribs, when we eat ribs, it's a bit of a violent activity. We're sort of snapping the ribs and we're really sort of gnawing at them to get, you know, as much of the meat as possible. And in early humans would have even been more violent. They would have been really just peeling the ribs back as much as possible to get at the marrow, to get, you know, sort of the best parts of the rib. And why that's interesting is in order to do that, you can imagine an animal being killed. The ribs are really sort of the most delicious parts. And so any animal that kills another animal is probably going to go after the ribs first. And so there's been some competing hypotheses about how our early ancestors got food. You know, were they hunters? Did they actually go out and kill these animals themselves? Or were they mainly scavengers? Did they wait for another animal to kill the prey that they were after and then came in afterwards and sort of dined on the leftovers? Well, if they're really getting to these ribs, you have to sort of assume, or at least these researchers say, you really have to assume that our ancestors were actually getting to these animals first. And if they got to them first, what that really indicates is that we were hunting these animals and not just scavenging them.
Is it possible that there could be, you know, alternative explanations for this? Maybe that other animals didn't value the ribs so much, or that there was some other order of events that could have happened?
Well, one possibility is that there was what's called aggressive scavenging going on. And this would still imply that our ancestors weren't hunting and killing these animals, that we were actually waiting for something else to hunt and kill them. But when that something else did hunt and kill them, we would scare that whatever that something else was away. And what's interesting about that is that's sort of seen as almost like a precursor of hunting. We weren't actually killing the animals themselves, but we were getting sort of bold and aggressive enough that we could sort of scare away another animal and sort of get to this food first. And that could be what happened here.
How interesting. And what else have we had on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a story about monitoring volcanic activity on Jupiter's moon Io from millions of miles away. Mm. Also a story about why we return or don't return the smiles of other people. And it has a lot to do with how we rank in the social hierarchy. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about the strange case of a Japanese stem cell researcher who's been involved in a big scandal over the last week or so that seems to involve some fabrication, some faked associations with powerful universities, and a bunch of other intriguing things. So check that out. I have also a story about a brand new weather and climate center in the United States. For Science Live, this week's Science Live is about the Nobel Prize, whether or not it's actually good for science. And next week's Science Live is about Neanderthals, whether they actually were a lot smarter than we've been giving them credit for. And finally, this week on the site, we announced the winner of the Dance Your PhD contest. This is our yearly contest where scientists try to interpret their PhD theses in dance form. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Yeah, I saw this one. It was a new spin on a burlesque, that's for sure.
Yes, exactly.
All right, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. While you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the October 19th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Edward Hermy.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.